The Faces of Contemporary Islam, Fresh Perspectives on Theory, Practice, and Foreign Policy, a Women's Foreign Policy Group Conference in Washington, D.C., featuring Carnegie Scholars. This November 18, 2008 podcast is a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The following panel, European Policies and Attitudes on Islam, features John Bowen, a professor at the Washington University in St. Louis and a 2005 Carnegie Scholar, and Susan Moeller of the International Center for Media and the Public Agenda at the University of Maryland and a 2008 Carnegie Scholar. Shireen Hunter moderates. Ms. Hunter is a visiting professor at the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at the Walsh School of Foreign Service, Georgetown University.
Please take your seat for our next panel.
Talk about the Islam in Europe. I think that we have heard so much about Islam and the West, and as if they were totally separate. But of course, now we have bits of Muslim world. In the West, in the form of Muslim communities. I personally became very much interested in this during my years of living both in England and in Brussels, and of course saw a lot in France. But this has been, as far as the U.S. interest in this issue is concerned, is a fairly recent phenomenon. Before that, wasn't really much interest. We have excellent, again, like all the other panels that you have had, excellent presentations. Unfortunately, one of our speakers, because of this Air France, I think Air France strike, she couldn't be here, although she tried very much. But this gives us an opportunity to hear from a bit longer comments from our other speakers here, John Bowen and Susan Moeller. Obviously, the question of Muslims in Europe is an important one, and it's facing actually European societies with a variety of challenges, including their own issue of identity, the question of the limits of European tolerance. It's very easy to be tolerant when you're Oral-like and you don't have anything to be tolerant of. But when you actually have to, there's a question of, integration, the meaning of integration. Is integration the same as assimilation? But also, I attended a conference, small conference, actually pretty big conference in Salzburg, and one of the participants who was a Muslim activist from UK and definitely very, very integrated, but he says that he had a fairly dark skin and so on. He says, but if you only look at my appearance, there's nothing I can do about my appearance. And these are some of the really major issues that are going on. And the other thing is also, because we're going to be focusing on specifics, but it's really not good to talk about Islam in Europe or Muslims in Europe. A title of early book that University of Louvain published in the late 1980s, because in Europe this was a focus of interest early on, and the title of the book, Les Islams d'Europe, the Islams of Europe. And that is true, because Muslim community in Europe is diverse. Moreover, each of the three main concentrations of Muslim have a different ethnic profile and so on. So this is something that is going to be with us. And so it's, Carnegie, like in many other things, has taken the lead in this area too. And we have excellent scholars that are working. And that's enough of me. And so I would like to give the floor to Professor Bowen. we're looking forward to your comments.
Thank you very much.
And you have a little bit more time.
Yes, I understand.
So that.
Thank you. I'm honored to be the one male member of the Carnegie Scholarship. Do you want me to be up there?
Yes, please start off with someone.
Easier to see, I think.
This one is on also. I'm honored to be one of the only male Carnegie Scholar asked to speak today. I slipped through some, and my name doesn't even have any gender ambiguities, but it's only half true because I'm also channeling Jet Clausen, who can't be here, and so I'm adding a bit of the Eastern and Northern perspective on what I have to say about Islams, Muslims in Europe, Europes. And the Europe's part is important because we don't really know what Europe is. You say, oh, come on. I mean, of course we do. But is Turkey in Europe? Anybody? Yes, no? No? Is that? Well, it's in the Council of Europe. And the Council of Europe are the countries that are subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court on Human Rights. And a number of major European decisions, including about headscarves, have come out of Turkey. Right, there's a number of different Europes, but Europe itself is so variegated in terms of its historical experience with Islam. We've got the southeastern portion, where you've got Muslims who have been Muslims for many generations. Of course, you have Turkey itself. You've got parts of Russia. You've got Andalusia with its memories of being part of the Islamic world. And then you have places such as Britain and France with long colonial experiences in parts of the Muslim world. And then you have places like the Scandinavian countries with very recent, very shallow relationships to a kind of a scattering of Muslim immigrants. So it's very difficult to generalize. Now, there's some things that we can say help us understand Europe in general, Western Europe, which is all I'll be speaking about, that there were these colonial ventures, especially involving France and Britain, but also involving Italy and Germany to a lesser extent, followed by labor migration from some majority Muslim countries, France earliest, starting in the late 19th century, but especially after the end of World War II for rebuilding Europe. Across many of these countries. Then there was a period during the 60s and early 70s where you had more and more families settling rather than simply patterns of circular migration. The recession in the mid-1970s curtailed that, the labor migration, but led to family reincorporation, new patterns of immigration. And then, of course, in the 1980s, a rise in identity, a sense of identity as being Muslims rather than as being North Africans or West Africans or South Asians, having to do both with the generational effects, more young Muslim men and women growing up and asking who they were, but also events taking place in the world. And then the 1990s and the 2000s, I think what we see is a divergence. We see a very small number of people becoming radicalized. You know all about, too much about them. And a much broader number of Muslims working with people in the various European countries, creating new institutions, seeking ways to have adaptation in both directions between Western European legal systems and Islam, leading to periods of experimentation, creativity with respect to schools, new ways of building mosques, new ways of thinking about even such very important but often overlooked practices such as sacrificial slaughter, sacrificial killing of animals. But through all this, one has to come back to the very different pathways that Muslims are following in each of several Western European countries. To talk about Euro-Islam or Muslims in Europe in general misses these deep-seated pathways. And I tend to analyze them in terms of two kinds of processes. One, I call transnational pathways. Where did Muslims come from in this particular case? Where did they settle? What sorts of continuing relations through marriage or communication do they have with their countries of origin? That's one sort of frame of analysis. The second is the kinds of structures of opportunity in each country, which basically means how we get things done here. Muslims, like all other immigrants, figure out pretty quickly how you get things done, and they adapt. So that's led to very different ways of building institutions and thinking about Islam in each of the European countries. So I'm going to give you four snapshots. And as I do, I'll bring in also, although not as much as I'd like, some of the important differences in the Muslim populations themselves that Shireen Hunter also underscored. I want to mention the UK, France, the Netherlands, and Germany, probably in descending order of time. if I had to sum up what we see in the UK, it really is a combination of distinct communities with strong transnational ties back to countries of origin. Why is this? Well, I'm bound to look at these transnational pathways and these structures of opportunity. The Muslims who came to Britain, to England in particular, were overwhelmingly from South Asia, Pakistan and Bangladesh in India. But even more interestingly was the very sort of narrow targeting that took people from a district called Mirpur and a district called Sylhet in Bangladesh and transplanted often subcaste groupings or villages over into neighborhoods in particular cities in Britain. So you have parts of Bradford or Birmingham, which were reorganized around these subcaste or these village patterns of authority, which also means then there's a preference to seeking spouses for children back to your own village or your own subcaste, often with a close kin. There's a tremendously high rate of close cousin marriages from these populations. Similarly, from Sylhet into East London. So very distinct local communities, which just happened to coincide with the structure of opportunity in Britain, which in the 60s and 70s was aiding local ethnic associations so that they can get things done locally. That's how you do it in Britain. You want halal food in the school? There's a local council. You want Islamic religious materials? There's a local group you work with, right? As in the 1980s, government aid pulled back, mosques filled some of the gap, this pattern of doing things locally was already there. Plus, you had this localism of residents, exacerbated by the fact that Muslims from the northern part of South Asia, that's probably the most divided part of the world in terms of theological schools. So you had where people came from. You had their particular allegiances, Barelvi Sufis or Deobandis or Tablighi Jama'ah people, reproduced in Britain. So a high degree of differentiation with a high degree of transnational ties. So it means now, for example, my project I'm involved in now is working with these Sharia councils or Sharia tribunals. Mediation bodies is really what they are. They're not courts. Which take on demands from women to seek divorces, Islamic divorces, because there's no Islamic court that can give them a divorce. I was at one of these sessions. These are incredibly transnational. I was at a session in May, for example, where there were seven cases. There was a woman from Somalia. There were several women from Pakistan. There was a woman from Mauritius. And the men were living currently in Italy, Pakistan, and Mauritius, and in two cases, places unknown. All right? Women came to seek Islamic divorces at these councils. The councils have a certain degree of legitimacy because of these pathways that have been laid down. Local control, reference to the transnational world from which people have come. All right. So this is a particular kind of set of transnational pathways and structures of opportunity which have produced very specific ways that Muslims have built institutions and thought about things. What they're doing at these Sharia tribunals is saying, how do we do it? What's the Hanafi way of doing things in, say, Pakistan? Can we do that here? If we can, let's do that. And these women, a woman may be from Pakistan. She may have been married in Yemen. She may end up remarrying back in Pakistan and settling in Dubai. So there's a great deal of attention to the international legitimacy of what these Sharia councils do. Let me turn to France. This is going to be brief, I know. France, I would characterize the overall pattern as being an emphasis on national, broad national organizations and playing down community differences. Now, this has again to do with the transnational pathways. France, far earlier than even England, was bringing people to work in French factories, replacing the men who fought in World War I, for example, or to fight in World War I and World War II. And this created a pattern of circular migration, largely from Algeria, which was part of France. It was not a colony. We have to remember that. There are citizens. There are people from Algeria in France today whose great-great-grandparents were citizens of France. They were second-class citizens, but nonetheless, they were citizens. But it created a very strong sense of Algerians angry about it, angry about inequality, angry about lack of opportunity, but being part of France nonetheless. It also It strongly affected the character of French of public discourse about Islam, because the largest group of Muslims in France, and it's, by the way, France has the largest percentage of Muslims, around 5%. They don't keep statistics, but that's what people guess. come from North Africa, where there are not the sorts of strong theological differences that characterize northern parts of South Asia. This is a historical accident, but it means that it's been relatively easy in France to build national organizations, confederations of various Islamic groups, to have a voice in national politics. Mosques tend to be multi-ethnic. There tend to often arguments about who gets to be the imam, but mosques tend to be multi-ethnic, whereas in Britain they're much more likely to be ethnically specific. This has also given rise to various forms of reasoning. France doesn't have a high level of toleration for public representations of ethnic or religious identity outside of a very narrow sense of what religion is, meaning churches, mosques, and things like this. But a Sharia tribunal, it's just unthinkable. Even people leafleting in the streets, it can be forbidden. There's a very narrow sense of what's possible, what's legally possible. So Muslims, as a result, have take it on very restricted kinds of institutional experiments with respect to mosques, to a very small degree with respect to Islamic private schools. And it means that Islamic thinking and institution building in France has been very different from England. A much stronger attempt to think about ways in which Islamic practices and French legal practices can find equivalences through contracts, for example. Can we think about a marriage in City Hall as being already an Islamic marriage? There's no attempt to give women Islamic divorces with a council. What imams tend to say is, look, if you've got a civil divorce, you're already divorced, as long as you weren't at fault, and just don't worry about it. God is all-knowing, and God will forgive. I'm going to turn to two other cases more briefly. First of all, the Netherlands, where I would characterize, again, this is very, very rough and very broad brush, the main tendency has been to create ethnic divisions, which is partly a result, again, of transnational pathways. Unlike Britain and France, who had strong colonial ties to the populations, majority populations who came to those countries, the Turks and the Moroccans, who make up most of the Muslims in the Netherlands, had no prior relationship to the Netherlands. Indonesians, of course, were a colony of the Netherlands, but the Indonesians in the Netherlands are majority non-Muslim. There are some Muslims there. They came into a structure of opportunity which was sort of on the last legs of something called the Verzuilingen policy, or pillarization, where the Catholics, different kinds of Protestants, and even the socialists in their own fashion had their own sort of had their own schools, their own religious organizations, their own political parties, even their own shops very often. So you could grow up only knowing people of your own religion. And Muslims saw this and said, hey, give us a pillar. You know, we have the right to one too. So we need our own schools with teachers teaching in Moroccan or teaching in Turkish. And of course, you know, we need mosques, et cetera, et cetera. And at the moment, there was no strong argument against this, except that this polarization policy was already starting to crumble a little bit in the Netherlands. But what it did do is trigger some Dutch policies for providing native language teachers in the native language of immigrants, for aiding people in terms of where they came from, et cetera. What's been produced, however, now is a policy where at first there was allowing of the immigrants, the Turks and Moroccans, to occupy their own pillar, to call it that. And then when the Dutch became aware of problems, very, very recently, the assassination of Van Gogh and others, there was a turn against this, a radical turn against this in a sense that these people are not fitting into our society at all, of great separation. Even Dutch policy today, however, identifies people by ethnic group, sorted into indigenous peoples, the autochtone, that's the Dutch, and then the allochtone, the others, the non-indigenous. And in fact, aid to school is based on where people come from. So that's more or less where we are today. A turn against this, in fact, the Dutch citizenship tests, if anyone's had a chance to read those, ask questions about values. Okay, what do you do if someone has a birthday party? Do you send flowers, send a card, or show up? A lot of Dutch people don't know, but if you're Moroccan, you don't know, you're not going to get in. Finally, Germany. Germany, again, very broad brush. I would focus on the tendency towards public sponsorship of religious groups as public corporations. Some of you may know, if you pay taxes in Germany, a little bit of your taxes goes to a church, and that also pays for your burial plot. That's a problem if you don't want to decide what religion you are and you want to be buried as opposed to cremated. And there has been an attempt to find the Muslim equivalent to these other religious corporations that already exist, so they can have their bit of the tax, so they could provide educational materials for schools. The problem is that Muslims coming into Turkey aren't really organized that way. And I need to say something at this point, a little bit about the Turkish specificity. I've mentioned South Asians, I've mentioned North Africans, I haven't talked about West African Sufi groups, but I could in discussion. The nature of the Turkish immigration has been very different. Again, no prior colonial relation, no great familiarity with German language or customs, although a long history of labor migration, labor recruitment. But the nature of the Turkish implantation in Germany also was that there were strong ties either back to the state, the Bureau of Religious Affairs in the Turkish government, or to the Miligurus, a large organization that has been important throughout Europe in starting mosques. So you have two competing networks of people, both with strong ties back to Turkey. Indeed, Turkish language television programs in Germany are as much aimed at Turkey as they are at Turks in Germany. Very strong sense of reference back to Turkey. Now, things are changing radically in Germany, as they are in many of these countries, from a situation where the Turks were considered to be never eligible for citizenship because of this ethnic notion of German citizenship, just to be guest workers. There has been a fairly rapid incorporation of some Turks into German political structures. Indeed, yesterday, the day before, the new leader of the Green Party is a Turkish politician who I had the opportunity to meet this past summer. So these things do change, and can change often quite rapidly. I haven't talked about Scandinavia, where one of the problems has been, it's been the epicenter of controversy about toleration. One of the problems in Scandinavia is the very recent character of labor migration from a whole number of countries, followed very quickly by refugees and seekers of asylum, the welcoming nature of many of the Scandinavian countries, thinking of Sweden in particular, has meant that there's a multitude of people from many, many backgrounds, all of whom happen to be Muslims, living in these countries, very often with the desire to go home at some point, which has meant that the incentive for Scandinavians to learn the languages of all these people, or vice versa, the incentives for many of these people to learn Swedish or Danish or whichever language it is, has been much, much lower than is the case for the other countries I've been mentioning, which has created a kind of a brittleness, a lack of bridge institutions compared to Britain or Germany or France or the Netherlands, and has resulted in some of the inabilities to work things out with intervening institutions that we saw, for example, in the Danish cartoon case. Well, I hope I've made the case that there are these deeply ingrained pathways in each of these countries, which has shaped the way, you know, the direction Muslims are going. Muslims in Britain are going towards, with a new generation, I think a different kind of Sharia council, where the new scholars, as they call them, not judges, are going to be people born in Britain with a very different idea of how to fit in, but they'll have their own institutions. They won't be courts, but they'll be tribunals. In France, if anything, we're moving away from that model entirely, where it's a much closer integration of civil law and Muslims. I don't see any Islamic institutions coming up in the near future that would have any legal impact. The Netherlands is between policies, but it has this emphasis on ethnic identity rather than religious identity, has had very specific effects on policy. That said, there are some currents that you can see, some developments that I think you can see in the future across Europe, and I'll close with this. I'll just mention one, which sounds trivial, but I think is very helpful, which is the importance of contracts. Many of you know contracts are extremely important in Islamic law. Marriage is a contract; it's not a sacrament. Many of the particular prescriptions and proscriptions one finds in scripture have to do with contracts. And creative jurists, both from Islamic backgrounds and from very civil law backgrounds in Europe, have started to work towards new ways of finding contracts as a bridge between the Islamic normative tradition and the various legal traditions of Europe. So I think some of our, one of the things we have to look at closely in the future, I myself do this, and along with many, many others, are the ways in which legal innovation, legal creativity can provide new institutions that will bridge these particular divides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan, for an excellent sort of overview of that. Obviously, this is a very complex issue, and there are too many things to cover. And now I have the pleasure to give the floor to Susan Müller. She's going to talk to us, I think, if I'm not wrong, about the media coverage of Muslims in Europe and United States.
Well, thank you very much, Shireen, and thanks very much to Patricia at the Women Foreign Policy Group and to the Ambika and Hillary and Patricia from Carnegie for including me here. I should say, for those of you who don't know or haven't looked at the bio, that I'm a 2008 Carnegie scholar, so I'm at the beginning of my research rather than at the end, but I am picking up projects that I've long worked on, so you'll forgive me for some lack of detail. But today I want to talk about how media, U.S. and U.K. media, cover Islam primarily for audiences who do not have a personal connection to it. And media across the board help their audiences define problems. And the way that media define problems, of course, obscures other ways of considering those problems. That itself is a problem. Also, media help to identify, help to forward solutions. But if they've constrained the understanding of problems, then of course the solutions that are likely to surface in the media are also themselves slightly constrained. It's one of the reasons why I believe that the media aspect of this is so critical. I want to start with three quick stories that speak to three pivotal issues. One relating to audience, the importance of audience, one relating to the importance of language, and one relating to the importance of content. One relating to audience is a personal story. I've been an academic for years and years, but I started out my career as a photographer and a reporter. And I covered the war in Salvador. When you cover the war in Salvador, basically you're not covering the conflict as it's going on, but you're there in the aftermath. The priest calls you and says, something happened, we need you to come document it. And I was more or less just off the plane on my first trip down there. Some of you may know I was there with Susan Micellis from Magnum and a few others. And we went to effectively what was a body dump. And she and I are standing next to each other, and I'm basically just trying to not lose it. And we're photographing, and she finished first and then turned to see what I was doing. And she said, Susan, what the hell are you doing? Excuse my language. And I said, I'm just photographing here? And she said, no. She said, put your camera up. So we put our cameras up, and we looked over here, which was the most sort of graphic part of the scene in front of us. And she said, see this photograph? No one in the world is going to publish this picture. Okay, click, 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 go another 15 degrees. See this photograph, which was still very graphic, but wasn't sort of in the severed head category, right? She said, all right, maybe Paris Match or Stern or something like that is going to publish this. No American publication is going to publish this. Click, click, click. Slightly less provocative, graphic. See this? Mother Jones and some of the alternative American periodicals are going to publish this. Click, click, click. And here you just have sort of evocative, not graphic, you know, sort of bare feet and a little puddle, so forth. That's the photograph that Time and Newsweek are going to publish. And it was one of those moments where literally at the time you could see the light bulb go off over my head, and I realized, reporters, but also their editors, make judgments about what they believe their audiences need to see, are interested in seeing. That's very much part of the issue with, excuse me for saying this, for your issues, for Islam. Second quick story. A number of years ago, I was hired by a UN agency to look at how three different groups prioritize human rights, NGOs, government, and the media. And for the most part, the UN agency believed that I would find that governments prioritized it number 10, that NGOs prioritized it number 1, and media prioritized it somewhere in the middle, depending. And that was fundamentally the case. But the much more important takeaway I did about 70 interviews with people in the U.S. and U.K. The most important takeaway from the study turned out to be that there were different operating definitions of what human rights meant. Within about a dozen interviews, I could tell you the person's job title by how they answered the question, "What do you think about in your job relating to human rights?" They all could reference the international documents. If you pushed them, they knew what human rights were according to Geneva Conventions, Vienna, so forth and so on. But that's not how they operated. So the reporter would say, "Human rights," I'm quoting, "always in my mind means killing, war, torture, and killing." NGO, head of one of the major human rights NGOs in the UK, "Human rights is a language of duty and communitarianism. We have to move from moral outrage to global responsibility." The World Bank, "Human rights is a very contentious issue. In the World Bank, you have a situation where the bank is governed by its members, and many of them, of course, really don't want the World Bank to dabble in human rights." All right, so what is this lesson? Your belief globally, your belief that language is transparent and shared is not true. Language is not transparent and shared, particularly in very basic terms like human rights, like terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and, of course, Islam. Third quick story, not my story. It's actually the story of Sherlock Holmes, and you remember his famous short story where he has that conversation with Inspector Gregory, the Scotland Yard less intelligent detective, about the clues over the racehorse Silver Blaze, who is missing. And the two men go over the facts in the case, and Inspector Gregory said, "Well, you know, is there any point to which you want to draw my attention to?" And Sherlock Holmes says, "Yes, actually, to that curious incident of the dog in the nighttime." Gregory's puzzled, and he said, "The dog did nothing in the nighttime." "Exactly," said Holmes. "That was a curious incident." Obviously pointing up that sins of omission are at least as important as sins of commission. In fiction, in politics, in relationships, often what is most important is what is not said. Terrorism, like human rights, like Islam, is very much in the eye of the beholder and is very often used to serve the agenda of the speaker. There is no shared legal definition of terrorism. And terrorism has been an arena in which media particularly have felt constrained to critique the government's messages about terrorism has, at least for a very long time, we've sort of slightly entered a slightly different situation in the last couple of years, but for about 5, 6, 7 years after 9/11, it's been constrained because if you critique the message of terrorism, there have been charges that you are effectively contemptuous of national security, contemptuous of men and women in uniform, and so forth. To the extent that Islam has been linked to terrorism, there is the same difficulty often in calling people out on that term. So politicians, in short, have had tremendous latitude to categorize events as terrorist, and individuals, groups, and even states as terrorist, and their appropriation of terms and their invention of terms, Islamofascist and so forth, has been part and parcel of that trend. All right, well, let me now move a little bit more specifically and talk in the couple of minutes that I have left about mostly coverage of Pakistan, because I think Pakistan raises some very interesting issues here, and I lived there for a year and a half and have gone back frequently. With extraordinary rare exceptions since 2001 in September, the coverage of Pakistan in both the UK and the American press has revolved around the roles that Pakistan has played in global terror. A couple of the exceptions are relating to the earthquake, for example. And there's been this really interesting, on the one hand, but on the other. It's a Western ally, but it's a base of operations for Osama bin Laden. It's a regional model of moderation. It's a tinderbox for regional conflict. It's a relatively stable state under Musharraf, under the control of what was typically considered a progressive military leader, or it's a shocking backwater of religious extremism. Now, there have been changes over time, and I'm conflating changes in time, and we can talk about that in the questions if you're interested. But I think one of the things that's interesting is when I lived in Pakistan, one of the things that repeatedly people from all around the country would tell me is that in Pakistan, people first claim their identity by their tribe, then by being Muslim, and finally by being Pakistani. From the outside, it's almost the reverse. People are understood. The country is, for the most part, and again, excuse me, because I am a reporter and I do understand that media are not monolithic and I'm talking about them in that way. And I'm happy to make clarifications again in the question time. But for the most part, the media have tarred the entire country with a very broad brush. And you would be familiar with this from their conversations about broadcast, print conversations about other countries, other groups, Palestinians, Iranians, and so forth. In one hand, one could argue, I think, looking at Pakistan, but also looking more broadly at coverage of Islam, particularly in the Middle East, the media's coverage of Islam is part of a general trend of the media, which is a tendency to use the term as an umbrella term rather than as a specific term. And because particularly in foreign policy and especially in national security issues, particularly those that deal with intelligence, media very much follow the administration, both literally and figuratively, literally in terms of the messages and literally in terms of literally being on the plane with the Secretary of State or the President and so forth. Now, when there is ongoing conflict, ongoing interest in a region, as has been the case, for example, in the Balkans, has been the case in parts of the Middle East and Pakistan and so forth, nuances do emerge. Things aren't seen so monolithically. And this is where I want to end up with a point, and I was very interested to hear the panel from the last group. Alora Shahabuddin talked about women and the perception of women. Okay. I wasn't sure what number. She was shuffling numbers, and I wasn't sure which number it was coming up.
You are very, very disciplined.
All right. When there's ongoing interest in the region, there is this nuanced structure. And in those instances, there are attempts to identify distinct groups within countries. You can think of Rwanda and the Hutus and Tutsis, an attempt to sort of define the good guys and the bad guys. In Kosovo, in the rest of the Balkans, again, that determination. Same thing has happened in the coverage of the war on terror as it's played out in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And it started post 9/11, and it started with the American press and then migrated elsewhere. So with the American press asking, why do they hate us? You all remember those sort of cover stories. Why do they hate us? It being understood, of course, who they were. They, of course, also being an umbrella term. Well, the sort of concomitant part of why do they hate us is there must be somebody who doesn't hate us. Who are the possible allies of that group that maybe we can convert, already converted, and we can help to get us to proselytize in our behalf? Well, as Alora mentioned, women were identified as those good Muslims, and it was through their intercession that the West would find the solution to violence. And what was very interesting, and I look both quantitatively and qualitatively at media and print and broadcast and so forth, that there were multiple frames in which women were identified as being potentially allies of the West, another problematic term. Women were seen as saviors. Transformative power of women was one of the reasons why explicitly there was such interest in women's education, because women could be transformed through education and then transform others. Women were identified as peacemakers. It was argued that they literally exercise a temperate influence, not only in the family level, but on the ethnic and national level. Articles about women who have been victimized, rapes, and so forth, helped to cement the notion that women were good and men were bad. And women were seen effectively as sort of the canary in the mines, that the health of women was sort of a prime indicator of political and religious tolerance. And finally, there was a sort of the question of, do we see women or do we not? And this is where the veil came into play so much. Women's clothing was a subject of intense interest. And the veil, although it was talked about in real terms, it was often, even in those articles where it was talked about in real terms, it was often used metaphorically. And that played out very, very interestingly. Well, let me sum up with a couple of thoughts. One of the things that...
1 minute. I'll be running very late.
One of the things that we've seen in the United States is not a tremendous change over time. But we have seen in the British press change over time, more or less dated to the aftermath of the July 2005 bombing and then the coming into Downing Street of Brown. And the change, what that meant was no longer looking at terrorism as sort of an act of war, but looking at terrorism as a crime, which allowed people to deal with it on a local level, and also the decoupling of Islam and terrorism in Britain in a way that has happened less dramatically in the United States until you come to the election, until you come to the sort of swift voting, as it were, of Barack Obama as Islam. So in last words, I think one of the things that's interesting to think about in terms of the U.S. case, because we all at least are at the moment resident in the United States, is in many ways it was the failures of the Bush administration's war on terror that changed the role of Muslim women in the political debate, because there was no longer, after the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, after Abu Ghraib, there was no longer the need to demonize Muslim men. Effectively, what happened was the demonization of the Americans. So the compelling story for media was no longer how to find the Muslim good guys. It was that Americans had become the bad guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For more information about this and other Women's Foreign Policy Group events, please visit www.wfpg.org.